Hi, this is Matt
and Sean
from Two Black Guys
with Good Credit. If you own or operate a business, whether it's a local operation or a global corporation, partnering with Bank of America could be your smartest move.
By teaming with Bank of America, you'll enjoy exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter.
Position your business to capitalize on opportunity in a moment's notice.
Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America, N.A., copyright 2024.
The Economist. Hello and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm Jason Palmer.
And I'm Ora Ogunbiyi. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world.
Recep Tayyip Erdogan's re-election as Turkey's president last year made his position look comfortable. But in this weekend's local elections, the opposition won, big, all over the country. We ask if it's at last time to start betting against Mr. Erdogan.
And did you know that sand is the most consumed natural resource in the world after water? It's everywhere. But the really high-quality sand, the kind needed to make the screen of the device that you're listening to me on, is harder to find and thus getting more expensive.
First up, though, there's something troubling going on with waistlines in India. For a long while, the country was associated with poverty and malnutrition. These days, there are far fewer undernourished people, and at the same time, a rise in obese ones. It's a trend seen in other developing economies, but in India, it'll prove harder to reverse.
In the decade and a half to 2021, the proportion of thin women in India halved, even as that of fat ones doubled, and that trend was even more pronounced among men.
Leo Marani is an India correspondent for The Economist and is based in Mumbai, which he insists on calling Bombay.
Today, 9.8% of Indian women and 5.4% of men are obese, up from 1.2% and 0.5% in 1990.
I mean, rising obesity sounds like a problem we've heard about before on the show quite a lot.
It's true. I mean, what I described is very common in developing countries. This is what academics and policymakers call a dual burden of undernutrition and weight gain. However, India is particularly concerning for two different reasons. One is just the massive scale of the country. There's 1.4 billion people here, and therefore it makes it a really urgent problem. But the other reason that India is particularly concerning is that there's a bunch of specific factors which are not the same as the ones in other developing countries or indeed the ones in rich countries.
And what are those?
One of them, sadly, we can't do anything about, and that one's genetics. So the South Asian phenotype is one that has less lean body mass, also known as muscle, and Indians are predisposed to adiposity, which is a nice way of saying we get fat. Even worse, we're predisposed to central obesity, which again is a nice way of saying that the fat gathers around the middle. In short, Indians put on weight, we get nice little paunches, and that's very bad for us because fat around your middle tends to put pressure on the vital organs, and that also has effects on developing non-communicable diseases such as heart disease, hypertension, diabetes, and so on.
This is going to have serious health outcomes for Indians, not just aesthetic ones.
Precisely. This is not just about my shirts not fitting me as well as they used to. Also, lots of Indians sort of drop dead of heart attacks. Lots of Indians have hypertension. And these things are all related. These non-communicable diseases or lifestyle diseases generally arise from diet and from exercise or lack thereof. And all of this puts enormous pressure on the country, right? I mean, it puts pressure on the health systems. It causes absenteeism. It reduces the quality of life, indeed the quantity of life. And these diseases are only growing. Between 2009 and 2019, the proportion of deaths and disability caused by heart disease grew by a third. Those caused by diabetes grew by a staggering 60%.
So, as you say, not much can be done about the genetic end of things, but you mentioned other factors.
Yeah, so one we can definitely do something about is diet. most Indians, including me, will tell you that there's no such thing as Indian food. It's a very diverse country with very diverse cuisines. However, some things do tend to be common across all of these cuisines, and that's a focus on carbohydrates. Now, in the West, if you think about the sorts of meals you and I have eaten, the centerpiece of that meal tends to be a nice big chunk of protein, right? In India, the centerpiece of the meal tends to be carbohydrates. It's rice or wheat, i.e. bread, and then some vegetables on the side. And very often the vegetable is potato, which is just more carbohydrate. I'll give you an example of a popular snack in Bombay, where I live. There's a vada pav. A pav is a bun, and a vada is spiced, batter-fried potato. So there you have carb on carb, deep-fried. I could go on. It's all delicious, by the way, I should say.
I'm getting hungry just listening to this. It's a shame that what you're describing is so terrible for the body.
Now, it's not just a rich person problem or a middle-class person problem. It is true that the wealthier you are, the more sedentary your lifestyle will be, and therefore the likelier that your carbohydrates just sit there and turn into fat. But amongst the poor, carbohydrates are the cheapest form of calorie consumption they have. And the government subsidizes this stuff or hands it out free, namely wheat, rice, and sugar. Meat is very expensive, fresh fruit and vegetables are expensive, they're luxuries, even pulses can be out of the reach of some people. So even though the poor do tend to move around more, they tend to do physical labor, their diets are also very carb-based. And the result of all of this is that 39% of the richest fifth of the Indian population is overweight, and as much as a tenth of the poorest fifth of the Indian population is overweight.
So in addressing at least that 10% of the poorest people, the government does have a lever to pull, just changing the food that it distributes, no?
I mean, that's one part of it. And I guess I should point out here that the government isn't a monolithic thing. There's the central government, and then there's 28 state governments that have their own policies and that are responsible, in fact, for what's known as the public distribution system, which is what hands out the grain. However, having said that, the other big problem here is food nationalism or the politicization of food. India has a reputation around the world and indeed in India itself as a predominantly vegetarian country. This is untrue. Pause while I look up that number.
Yeah, pause while I don't reveal to our listeners the zeal with which I have seen you consume multiple steaks.
Now, 70% of women in this country and 83% of men consume some form of animal protein. That could just be eggs, it could be chicken, or it could be mutton. I mean, very, very rare for anyone to consume pork or beef. But that's a huge, huge chunk of this country, right? However, animal protein is rarely prioritized in nutritional advice, and even attempts to introduce it are met with hostility. So I'll give you one example. Many states provide free school lunches to poor pupils, but a big chunk of those states refuse to serve eggs because they think it goes against an upper caste version of Hinduism, and therefore it'll ritually pollute the children and so on and so forth, even though the parents of these children are perfectly happy for them to be served eggs. Another example, I was chatting with a professor at a very prestigious Indian university who said that his own students say to him that our cuisine is the best, we don't need to change anything, we don't need to learn anything, meat causes cancer, look at all these people in the West, they're all dying. Another person I spoke to who, in addition to having written a book about India's food, is also a YouTuber, he says he confronts these food nationalists every day. So there's a lot of this sort of thing as well, which prevents us from changing the way we eat.
So what is the solution then to this growing problem?
Education is the first one, obviously. And in order to help with that, India's Food Standards Agency is working on a food labeling scheme, which will rate the healthiness of products on a 5-star scale. That only addresses part of the problem. Obviously, not everybody buys packaged goods and so on and so forth. Another thing that's been going on in India is that the Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, who's hugely influential, right? People listen to him, and he's thrown his weight behind improving the variety of grain that Indians eat. So he's been pushing, and his government has been pushing millets, which are a healthier sort of grain.
Aap sabhi ko global millet conference ke ayojan ke liye hardik shubhkamnaye.
And although there's no data to show that it's been hugely effective so far, anecdotally, I can tell you that lots of people have started including millets in their diets. I have done so as well. And you find millet-based foods in restaurants and packaged snacks and so on and so forth. However, both of these things that I've mentioned are barely scratching the surface. India needs a serious overhaul in the way it thinks about food, and that can really only come from governments, from public awareness campaigns, and from a serious rethinking of the public distribution, the welfare system as well.
Leo, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me, Jason. Always a pleasure.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Over the weekend, on March 31st, I was in Istanbul at the headquarters of the Republican People's Party, or CHP, Turkey's main opposition party, to watch the local elections and especially the race for the mayorship of Istanbul.
Pyotr Zalewski is our Turkey correspondent.
I was there with other journalists, but also with the mayor himself, Ekrem İmamoğlu, who was running for a second term. After it became clear that İmamoğlu would win, I headed to City Hall, where I found thousands, perhaps tens of thousands, of CHP supporters listening to İmamoğlu give his victory speech, but also singing, dancing, lighting flares, and honking. No poll and practically no pundit, no one in Turkey, I think, could have predicted what actually happened on election day. And that was a nationwide victory by the CHP. Now, the polls had given the CHP under 30% nationwide. In the end, the party got almost 38%, 2% more than the ruling Justice and Development Party, the party of Turkey's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. That difference of the AKP masks huge gains for the opposition in some of the most important places in Turkey, and the results are sure to reshape national politics.
So where has the opposition made these sort of surprise gains then?
Well, nearly everywhere. In Istanbul, the city's incumbent CHP mayor coasted to another term, winning by double digits. In Ankara, the second biggest city and the nation's capital, the CHP's mayor, Mansur Yavaş, won by around 29%. On Izmir, the third biggest city, the CHP's man won by 12 points. The opposition was expected to do well in the cities, although not as well as it eventually ended up doing. But perhaps more significantly, for the first time in decades, it also made major inroads in small towns and villages. The CHP has returned the best showing in any election since 1977, and this less than a year after very disappointing general election results.
So what's behind this then? Why the big surprise?
Well, one way of looking at this is that this is an opposition upset that is 10 months delayed. 10 months ago, Turkey had general, meaning presidential and parliamentary elections, and in those, the CHP and its presidential candidate underperformed, and underperformed badly. Now, how is it that a party, an opposition party, that gets 25.3% in June, gets 37.7% just 10 months later? Well, one reason seems to be the economy. Despite the promises that President Erdogan made last summer, the economy remains in the doldrums. Even after interest rate increases to the magnitude of over 40%, inflation has continued to rise and is now closing in on 70%. Cheap credit and government largesse have run out. Mr. Erdogan can no longer offer voters the kind of handouts he was able to offer in the run-up to last summer's election, handouts that helped shield them from rocketing consumer prices. In other words, there is no masking the economic pain.
So it's simply that Mr. Erdogan can no longer afford to buy a lot of voters' loyalty?
Well, to some extent, those handouts helped people cope with raging inflation in the past. Keeping interest rates low was something of a buffer for those who had access to credit. And now Turks are experiencing the worst of both worlds, meaning extremely high inflation and very high interest rates. Among other things, what helped the opposition was an overhaul of the CHP's leadership. Last November, the party deposed its longtime leader, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, and replaced him with Özgür Özel, who is much closer to Mr. İmamoğlu. Mr. Kılıçdaroğlu was largely blamed for the CHP's losing performance in last summer's election and for losing the presidency or squandering what seemed to be a golden opportunity to unseat Mr. Erdogan as president. Mr. Kılıçdaroğlu himself was the CHP's candidate. Another factor in this election was a strong showing for New Welfare, a newly formed Islamist party, a party which recently split from Mr. Erdogan's governing coalition, took more than 6% of the overall vote, a rather remarkable result. I mean, this is only second to the AK Party and the CHP, and it won outright in two of Turkey's 81 provinces. That result suggests that the AK Party can no longer take hardline Islamist voters for granted.
And you said before that this result would reshape Turkey's politics. What do you mean by that?
A victory for AK would have made it easier for Mr. Erdogan to push ahead with a new constitution, which would presumably have included another term for Mr. Erdogan, who is now in the second term of his presidency. But the scale of the AK Party's losses means those changes are now unlikely to be brought forward because they would have to be put to a referendum, which it seems Mr. Erdogan would now have a far bigger chance of losing. So Mr. Erdogan may soon have no other choice but to speed up plans to find his successor, the successor for the AK Party. The biggest concern for him is the electoral avalanche in Istanbul, a city that makes and breaks careers, including his own. Mr. Erdogan went from mayor of Istanbul in the 1990s to leader of the AK Party in the 2000s, and then prime minister and eventually president. It seems that Mr. İmamoğlu's chances of following the same trajectory have now vastly improved.
Which is to say, from here, you can see a potential end to Mr. Erdogan's political career?
No one has ever made any money betting against Tayyip Erdogan. So to assume that this is the end for him, I think, is going a tad too far. But this is certainly the biggest defeat in his 22-year national career. And it's the biggest defeat for his party as well. He has pledged to rebuild, to come back stronger in time for the 2028 presidential and parliamentary elections. So he's clearly not going anywhere without a fight. But he now has a very robust, a very strong, resurgent opposition facing him. And the last thing he wants is for someone like Mr. İmamoğlu to run in 2028, to win in 2028, and to inherit the kind of executive presidency that Mr. Erdogan has designed, a presidency that places almost no checks on his powers. To him, İmamoğlu winning the presidency would mean all of the power accruing to the opposition. And that for him is a nightmare scenario.
Piotr, thank you very much for your time.
And thank you for having me.
Sand is everywhere, but not all kinds of sand can be used to make the glass needed for solar panels or smartphones.
Carla Subirana is a digital journalist at The Economist.
These objects need ultra-clear glass, which can only be made using high-quality silica sand.
High-clarity tempered glass. It has to be very pure. It requires very pure sand.
That's Bruce Malouche, the managing director of VRX Silica, a sand mining company in Australia. He told me that high-quality sand is becoming scarce.
And it's just increasingly becoming much more difficult to source high-quality sand.
Sand is one of the most mined commodities on Earth. More than 50 billion tons are extracted each year. But less than 1% of that can be used to produce regular glass. And even a smaller fraction is pure enough for solar panels. Demand is rising because China is trying to revive its economy by throwing cash at manufacturing firms. So this essentially means that the production of objects that require lots of high-quality sand is increasing, especially solar panels. That is making it very hard for companies to find high-quality sand. And as a result, demand will probably rise even higher.
Carla, tell me a bit more about the impact that this is all having on the market for sand.
Well, it's very hard to know what the actual price of sand is because it's a very opaque and fragmented market. Most companies use sand that is sourced locally and is not a commodity that is traded in global markets. But mining companies say that prices have been near all-time highs during the past years. Last year, prices came to around $55 a ton. And Crooks Investor, a data company, says that the price of high-quality silica sand has risen twice as much as that of lower-quality sands, which are used for construction, during the past 5 years.
So why is the price of sand going up so much?
Well, the main reason is a rise in demand because of the growth of Chinese solar panels, but other factors are also pushing prices up. One is that during the past years, most Asian countries have introduced some sort of export control on sand. Governments have realized that high-quality sand is being mined at a faster rate than it can be repleted, so they're worried about shortages. And sand mining is very bad for the environment. Most high-quality silica sand is found in freshwater rivers, so extracting too much of it can lead to floods or damage local fisheries. So to protect themselves from shortages or environmental degradation, governments are making it very hard to export sand. And another problem is that America has very big reserves of high-quality sand, but it also has very tough environmental rules, so this makes extraction very hard.
So aside from the freshwater rivers, are there any alternative sources of this kind of high-quality sand?
Yeah, one option is refining lower-quality sands used for regular glass. That's not really a very good solution because it's very expensive. But with prices rising so much, miners have spotted an opportunity. So in the coming years, we will probably see an increase in extraction. And that could come from both legal or illegal mining. The black market is huge. It's estimated to be worth hundreds of billions of dollars a year because governments make very little effort to track sand. So it's very hard for companies to know whether the sand they're using is legal. And illegal mining will probably grow as prices continue to rise. But in terms of the legal boom, Brazil and Australia are probably the main countries that will expand production. You probably know these countries for their beautiful white beaches, but in fact, they also have very big reserves of industrial sand. And unlike in America, they are often far away from cities or villages, so this makes extracting sand easier. And currently, they're not very big exporters because exporting sand is logistically very hard and expensive. So essentially, until recently, the price of sand wasn't high enough to cover shipping costs. And because neither of these countries are big glass manufacturers, they didn't really have a lot of domestic demand, so production was never really that high. But lots of mining companies said to me that prices have risen so much that now it's become more economic to export sand, and many are planning to expand production.
And so if the likes of Australia and Brazil do, could that solve the problem?
Yeah, I think so. Brian Liners from Homerun Resources said to me that neither country is in China's sphere of influence, so Brazil could help Western supply chains become more resilient.
The reliance on the Chinese for critical elements has obviously become a regional and a political problem.
And he also pointed out that Brazil's shipping lanes are less prone to disruption.
But also, if you look at the logistics, it's a direct shipping lane to Europe. It's a direct shipping lane to North America.
Brazil's shipping lanes avoid the Panama Canal, which is being hit by a drought caused by climate change, and the Red Sea, which is being bombarded by Houthi rebels. And my feeling is that this is a familiar story. People have panicked in recent years over shortages of many important commodities for the green transition, such as cobalt or lithium, which has caused their price to spike. But often what has ended up happening is that new supplies or cheaper alternatives have been found, and the shortages never really materialized. So I think that high-quality sand could be the next to follow this path. It will just take some time while companies wait for the permits for extraction to be approved.
Carla, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ori.
That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Hi, this is Janice Torres from Yo Quiero Dinero. If you own or operate a business, whether it's a local operation or a global corporation, partnering with Bank of America could be your smartest move. By teaming with Bank of America, you'll enjoy exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter. Position your business to capitalize on opportunity in a moment's notice. Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America NA, copyright 2024.